From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts. The journalist Joan Biskupic has a new book exploring Roberts' life, his home, his school. A sober and serious kid, he thrived on formality. She writes about his political education, too, his commitment to ideological conservatism, and how he finds himself trying to be a conservative, but also protect the institution of the court. We'll be right back.
Hey there, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. If you enjoy the show, we'd appreciate it if you did us a little favor. Find us on the iTunes store and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It's valuable feedback for us, and frankly, the more reviews we have, the more listeners we can attract. Thanks in advance. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West, and Buck Fabrizio. John Roberts could be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court for 20 more years. The way he manages the affairs of the justices and the votes they take is going to have a powerful influence on American society. Roberts, of course, is a conservative, even though he has said the court doesn't do its business in a partisan or ideological manner. Joan Biskupic says he knows better. In her new book, she explains how Roberts arrived in Washington just as conservatism was on the rise, how he worked in the Reagan and George Bush Sr. administrations, and how he played plenty of politics. But Biskupic says now that Justice Anthony Kennedy has retired and the court has a conservative majority, Roberts has two paths he can take. Does he hew to his conservative roots, or does he work to find common ground? Biskupic's book is about Roberts' climb to this top position in American law, but also his early life, his political life. Her book is called The Chief. Joan Biskupic is a legal analyst for CNN, the author of a number of biographies of Supreme Court justices, Sonia Sotomayor, Sandra Day O'Connor, Antonin Scalia. She joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., and Biskupic says she approached Roberts a few years ago with the idea for the book, and he wasn't crazy about it.
When I first started this book, it was late 2015. Justice Scalia was still alive. Anthony Kennedy was in control and the decider on this court. And things changed so much. I sent the chief a note in spring of 2016 telling him I was doing this book. I really wanted to explain him to readers. And I'd already done books, as you know, on the first woman on the court, the first Italian-American, the first Hispanic justice. And I felt it was important to take on someone who didn't have that kind of obvious demographic identity, but was so crucial to what was happening up there. One thing I will say as an aside, and that I kept saying to him, he's only the 17th Chief Justice, and we've had 45 presidents. So when I was trying to convince him to be a bit of a more cooperative subject, I was saying, you know, what you do is so important and people want to know what you're all about. So we start out this way and he's reluctant and he initially doesn't want to meet with me at all. He at first was very tentative and he wanted to keep everything off the record. And then over a series of interviews, we would negotiate what I could use for the book and what I couldn't. Yeah. And you're exactly right. What he said was, look, any kind of exploration of me as Chief Justice should come when I'm gone. But I said, when you're gone, I'll probably be gone too. So that will not work. That won't work. And plus, as a daily journalist or as a longtime journalist, you know, worked news, all sorts of news organizations over the past 25, 30 years, I enjoy finding out about people who are still in power. So this was a project I wanted to do. But slowly, Doug, he began to warm up and tell me things and show more of himself, although I would often feel like I was seeing so many different sides of him. And in the end, he did say that he felt he was more cooperative than he anticipated being. But I said, you were nothing like Justice Scalia, who sat for 12 on the record interviews, which were very helpful, I think, to Justice Scalia and certainly to me.
What did it say that he didn't want to go on the record for much of that? What's the difference there between Scalia and Roberts? I mean, Scalia was careful himself, I'm sure, about revealing too much of his judicial opinions. What made John Roberts so reticent, do you think?
A couple of reasons, but let's start with the most basic. He believes that his background, what life was like for him as a child, his educational experience, his work experience along the way, really shouldn't shape how he views the law. Yeah. He says that how he views the law is through the lens of, you know, precedent, legal rulings. He famously said during his confirmation hearing that he's just calling balls and strikes. He's acting like an umpire. So to reveal more of his personal self, I think, suggests, at least in his mind, that he's trying to draw a connection between his personal self and how he rules. And I actually think that all of these justices cannot help but be influenced by their own backgrounds and experiences. So that was the first thing. The second thing is the chief is a very controlled, careful, reserved individual in so many ways. And I had found, Doug, through my longtime reporting on the court, that even on topics that did not involve him personally, he was always reluctant to go on record. For various projects, when I could get all other eight to speak on the record about Supreme Court practices, and I did a huge project on whose cases tend to get accepted, who wins and loses in the, you know, elite Supreme Court bar, all the other justices would talk to me on the record and the chief wouldn't. And I found that particularly troubling, especially because the chief was one time a sterling oral advocate before the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. arguing 39 cases, many successfully.
It's interesting that and we'll get into his childhood here in a moment. But while you're on the subject of media coverage, one of the things that you, and there are a few of these circumstances in the book that you write about, he was bothered by how he was, often bothered anyway, by how he was portrayed in the news media. He could be irked by things that other people would say or the way he was covered. You mention in the book his coverage by the Washington Post when he was nominated by George Bush Jr. to a D.C. Circuit position, and that he was, in the Washington Post article, more connected with the Federalist Society than he was comfortable with. And he was annoyed by that. He wanted a, if not a retraction, a kind of correction. All of which just says to me that he's paying attention to all of this stuff. He's paying attention to his public persona, how he's covered. And that seems to have been the case throughout maybe his public life anyway.
That's exactly right. And the incident you're referring to involved him not wanting to be portrayed as a member of the Federalist Society, even though the reporters involved in that story had later found documentation that showed that he had, you know, regularly attended and had been on some membership committee. Now, we can go back and forth on just how much of a member he was and how careful he was not to be associated with the Federalist Society. But it does point up the fact that he was watching and he was careful about how he could be portrayed in a way that might hurt him down the road. Now, if you're nominated by a Republican administration, as he was, you want the stamp of approval from the Federalist Society, which is very tied in with this White House and prior White Houses in screening applicants. So he did have the seal of approval from the Federalist Society, but it certainly doesn't help when you're looking for bipartisan support in the Senate for confirmation.
Right. Well, he was aware of the political maneuvering, and we'll get back to that, because he played a role in picking judges and advising judges who were nominated, which is I think, quite interesting and telling in the way he performed himself in confirmation hearing. He said in an interview that when people asked if there was anything that they could do for him during a confirmation process, he would sort of say in a joking way, well, you could write an op-ed in the Post saying that I'm a squish. In other words, he was very aware of how these things played out in public. Mention that, because again, this awareness of how these things worked, the deliberation process, the political process, his image in the public, well, he was very conscious of that.
That's right. From day one, in fact, you're right to remind our listeners that in his very first days on the job for the Reagan administration back in 1981, he helped prepare materials for Sandra Day O'Connor's confirmation as the first woman appointee nominated then by Ronald Reagan. So John Roberts knew already, you know, what it was all about, and even wrote at the time, back in 1981, a memo that said the key here is to suggest that you are answering the question, but without ever answering the question.
Yeah.
Give the senators plenty of information, you know, be very affirming of their questions, but don't give them the goods, essentially. I'm certainly paraphrasing there. But he then, after we move from the Reagan administration to the George H.W. Bush administration, he was part of the judge-picking machine there, and then, of course, gets nominated by George H.W. Bush in 1992 to a prestigious appeals court slot that he does not get. The Senate does not act on that. And that just further reinforced his idea that he had to be careful with how he was portrayed and received.
And one of the rare times when things didn't go his way, I have to say, this almost seemed like a theme in the book when he has there's a famous speech that he gives that goes viral to his speaking to his son's prep school, I think it is, talking about he wishes that they will encounter failure or loneliness or setbacks. And it seems like kind of an ironic thing to say in the life of a man who had a few personal heartbreaking moments with I'm thinking about a child that they were trying to adopt and that didn't work out. And that particular case you mentioned, there were a few, but there weren't really many. He seems to have lived a pretty great life, and then suggesting to young people that he hopes they encounter setbacks seemed, I don't know, interesting.
Yes, and you mentioned that early attempted adoption. They end up having two children in 2000 through adoption. That was a wonderful experience for them. A little bit before that episode, a birth mother had pulled back at the last minute.
Yeah.
And Jane Roberts, his wife, who spoke with me extensively in two long interviews, was very upfront about it. In fact, just as an aside, her personality is almost the opposite of the chief's. You know, she wants to talk about their life. She's very proud of the people they are and proud of the decisions they've made along the way. But friends didn't refer to that much when I would say, what do you remember being their setbacks? And, you know, a lot of people would refer to the 1992 the inaction by the Senate on his nomination then, and, you know, some childhood tales about maybe he wasn't that good in some sports. But you're right. Overall, his life wasn't marked by the kinds of setbacks, losses that often define a very public person. And I will mention one other thing, Doug. You know that speech that you referred to that he gave at his son's boarding school graduation?
Yeah.
It did go viral, but there's another one that he gave that I think equally reflects him and perhaps maybe might more accurately reflect his attitude. It was in 2013, and he was speaking to graduates at his own boarding school, La Lumiere in northern Indiana. And he was saying that of all the traits that are important for success in life, persistence is the most important.
Yeah.
He said you can be born with talent. You can have talent. You can have good looks. You can have a family with money. You can have location. You can have the best education. But what really matters is persistence. And I thought that was revealing because John Roberts has been a very persistent, determined individual. But he also came with a pretty great package along the way. And I don't want to take anything off of the serious student, the excellent student he was at that prep school. He was number one in his class, and he goes off to Harvard undergrad and Harvard law. But he certainly had a lot of those other things going for him along the way.
Let's do talk about his childhood a bit. You say by the age of 13. Now, you mentioned, describe him as, and I guess no one would be surprised by the fact that he was sober, a serious kid. I like that they called him Jackie at first, but at some point he insisted on John.
He thought Jackie might have sounded like too much like a girl.
Yeah. Let's talk about at 13, you say he had kind of a clear plan. What do you mean by a clear plan for his life? What does he have in mind for himself in that age?
Well, he writes to the headmaster of the school where he's applying at age 13. And he's lucky enough that just as the family is settling in northern Indiana, where the father is a Bethlehem Steel executive, a new boarding school has opened up. And he writes and he says, "The main reason I would like to attend La Lumiere School is to get a better education. I've always wanted to stay ahead of the crowd, and I feel like the competition at La Lumiere will make me work as hard as I can." And he closes this letter by saying, "I won't be content to get a good job by getting a good education. I want to get the best job by getting the best education." And I think themes in this letter are seen throughout his adult life.
It's interesting to see how race comes into play quite early on, at least in his childhood. Whether he was aware of it or not is really interesting. You mentioned now he grows up in this really sheltered place called Long Beach, Indiana, because he's the son of an executive at Bethlehem Steel. So does pretty well, his family. But you also describe it as one of the most segregated places in the country. So talk a little bit about, and this is also at a time when Brown versus the Board of Education is sort of playing out in the public conversation. So what is going on in terms of race and John Roberts' awareness of race in that time of his life?
So here we are at a time when civil rights unrest is gripping the country. Mm-hmm. We're in the 60s and 70s, and he's growing up in this one-time vacation community of Long Beach, Indiana. It's about 60 miles from Chicago. It's not too far from Detroit, not far at all from Gary, but it's a pretty insulated world away from the urban strife and other racial discord of the day. And I don't think in this elite boarding school, there were at least two African Americans during his time there that the school had brought in from suburban Chicago. And so it wasn't as if he didn't have any black students around, but everything was so predominantly white. But I'll tell you how some of the racial tensions were playing out, perhaps in a way that he would be aware of. One of the first industries that the federal government went after for desegregation efforts was the steel industry. Right. So the Department of Justice is targeting major steel companies such as Bethlehem Steel, and they're imposing quotas and their variations of quotas, sometimes real quotas, sometimes other goals and timetables. And this becomes a big deal for that industry. And then he goes to Harvard in the early 70s at a time when, again, numbers are being counted constantly, you know, how many blacks are on campus, how many women, how many, you know, in the faculty. That is a story that's constantly being played out in the Harvard Crimson when he's there. So this is in the air, but it's in the air in terms of the tension and the controversy. And while he's at Harvard Law School, the important Supreme Court ruling in the Bakke case, the case of mm-hmm. Alan Bakke, is decided by 5-4, with the justices saying, no, you can't impose quotas in higher education, but schools can consider race as part of many criteria that they examine when looking at applications. And that becomes controversial. So it's there, it's out there. And he would not address it, although he has said that he was turned off by the liberalism at Harvard. But lucky guy, just as he graduates, the conservatism of Ronald Reagan is ascending.
Well, say something about his timing, because you mentioned it seems like his life had perfect timing. He as you say, the conservatism the conservatives weren't well liked in Harvard at the time you mentioned. But as you say, as he leaves, that is the emerging ideology in the country, it seems.
That's right. And in fact, when he starts at Harvard, there's a Young Republicans Club that hardly anybody was signing up for. But his year, they happened to have some record numbers. And there was a news story in the campus paper revealing all sorts of surprise from people saying, boy, in the wake of Watergate, you still have a bunch of people wanting to sign up. And indeed, those were the first signs of what then, of course, emerged in the 1980 election of Ronald Reagan. And John Roberts, after he graduates from Harvard in 1979, is fortunate enough to have two very prestigious judicial clerkships, one with a judge in New York, appeals court judge Henry Friendly, and then with then Associate Justice William Rehnquist, who, of course, then eventually becomes Chief Justice. But both of those were very influential on young John Roberts, especially the second with William Rehnquist. He saw how Rehnquist worked, and he appreciated that. And then he goes right from there to the Reagan administration.
It's interesting you say that he related to Henry Friendly's judicial disposition in some ways, but was more aligned with Rehnquist's ideological disposition. It seems like there were two parts that he was looking at in those early experiences.
That's right. For some of your listeners who might not recall Judge Henry Friendly, who was on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, he was regarded as one of the greatest judges of his era, yeah. As a real judge's judge, a man of a lot of integrity, not ideologically driven, had a lot of the same background as John Roberts. He had also gone to Harvard undergrad and Harvard Law School and had done very well, written stellar papers that won the same kind of awards that John Roberts' papers had won. So John Roberts really liked the identification with Henry Friendly. But it was William Rehnquist and his ideological approach that seriously also shaped John Roberts. And that certainly has emerged more in his jurisprudence than Henry Friendly.
How do you describe his conservative ideology? Where does he fit? It's, as you say, as the Reagan administration is taking hold, conservatism is on the ascendancy. What was it that appealed to John Roberts? What was the economic dimensions, the social dimensions of conservatism that he liked?
It's sort of all of the above. In fact, at one point, he writes to Henry Friendly when he's working in the Reagan administration. He writes to his old mentor and he says, "This is such an exciting time to be in the Department of Justice when everything that had been taken for granted is being challenged." John Roberts, at that point in that letter, happened to be referring mostly to protections for criminal defendants that he suggests had been too broadly interpreted by the court under Earl Warren and even by extension under Warren Burger, even though Warren Burger, as an individual justice, was known to be tougher on crime than the majority who was leading at the time on the Supreme Court. So John Roberts is very excited about trying to rein in some constitutional protections, some statutory protections. But he also is someone who has expresses views during that time against abortion rights, against racial remedies such as campus affirmative action. And, he has an interest in a lower wall of separation between church and state. So all of the culture wars issues that Ronald Reagan's presidency incited in many ways, he becomes part of.
Joan Biskupic, her book is The Chief: The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Support for KUER comes from the local and national businesses around the state that underwrite our programming. Shows like Morning Edition, Radio West, and All Things Considered. If your business or organization cares about the in-depth local news and fascinating conversations you can only find on public radio, team up with KUER. To learn more about becoming an underwriter, look for the Support tab at KUER.org and click on Business Support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts. The journalist Joan Biskupic has a new book exploring Roberts' life and his political education as well. The book is called The Chief: The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts. I want to talk a little bit more about this theme in the book, I think, that balance that he's trying to find between the institution of the Supreme Court now, protecting the institution, and planting seeds that favor his own ideology, which is something he gets from Rehnquist, you write about. But how Did he? You say that he was hardwired to be a judge. Did he have in mind, at what point does he get in his mind that he wants to be a judge? Because you also write about how he considered getting a PhD in history and how he imagined maybe he would be a professor more than a litigator. So it seems like he did have other options in mind, and it wasn't necessarily just the political dimensions or even the judicial dimensions.
You know, that's exactly right. And you look back on how he was shaped in the turns he took, lots of paths were open to John Roberts. He was very talented, excellent writer, super smart, focused, driven. And so he goes to Harvard thinking he's going to be a history PhD. Mm-hmm. But for all of us who were of that era, we remember how there was this glut of professors during that time, and especially in the humanities. And his advisor suggested he might want to look elsewhere. So he goes to Harvard instead for law school. He's always been a student of history and remains a student of history, but he drops it as a profession. And then even then, as you say, he was thinking about taking a much more intellectual approach. And I think that appealed to him in Judge Henry Friendly's chambers. But once he gets to Washington, he is so energized by the political scene. And he feels a real camaraderie with the political operators and is very good at it. He's actually very good at creating talking points and paying attention to the press, not just for himself, as you mentioned earlier, Doug, but for the whole administration. And this sets him on this path. So he's working as a lawyer throughout the Reagan administration, and then he becomes an appellate lawyer early on before he then joins the H.W. Bush administration. But it's in the H.W. Bush administration that his interest in becoming a judge occurs. And they nominate him on his 37th birthday in January of 1992. They wanted him to seem a little bit older, so they said, let's wait for your birthday.
Right. Yeah, he was young.
You can be at least 37, not 36. Right. And that's when he decides. But he's nominated. They work with him on which court to go to, and it's the D.C. Circuit, which is a true stepping stone to the Supreme Court. In fact, he eventually gets on the D.C. Circuit during the younger President Bush's tenure, but think of all the members of the Supreme Court we have now who had been there before, including Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Clarence Thomas, Brett Kavanaugh, and Antonin Scalia was also on the D.C. Circuit earlier too. So he knew the best place to be to move up in the judicial hierarchy.
Well, you also write about how he. And again, this seemed like a kind of crafted plan. He moves to build a specialized appellate practice, which was a lucrative move, but also got him distinguished as a lawyer and made it seem to me like this was, you know, he has a plan here. And he joins the Solicitor General's office in the late 1980s. There was a kind of a courtly formality there, and I think that must have been appealing to him. And you mentioned you mentioned Rex Lee, one of Reagan's solicitor generals, and you mentioned that Roberts didn't think Rex Lee was, as you put it, sufficiently committed to Ronald Reagan's conservative social mandate, which I think was interesting that he is thinking about how ideology can be fit into judicial rulings, even then. So there was a political dimension, even though he tried to say that he didn't think in those terms. It seemed like that was revealed quite early in his life.
It's so interesting you focus on that, because a couple other of my readers early on were like, wow, it's not just that he was a loyal lieutenant to Ronald Reagan. He wanted to chastise other people in the administration who he felt weren't equally committed. And at this time, we're talking about a young man who's, you know, barely out of his mid-20s writing memos to his bosses saying, hey, we have to rein this guy in. Look what this man said. You know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm sure that if John Roberts were in this conversation, he'd say he had nothing but respect for Rex Lee, because Rex Lee is somebody who deserved a lot of respect in the way he operated. But in those moments when John Roberts was working in the Department of Justice and then the White House, he was watching to see how Rex Lee articulated the Reagan agenda and how committed he was along the way. And when he took a detour in John Roberts' mind, he wrote a memo.
Yeah. You say in the book that almost immediately, as soon as he had gotten the job as Deputy Solicitor General, that he developed these arguments against governmental policies that gave a boost to blacks, Hispanics, and other minorities. And then I was making a list. I kind of went down this litany of some of his arguments that he's writing then. He wrote briefs that suggested limiting judicial oversight of segregated school systems. He was outspoken against government remedies for the effects of segregation. He wrote that federal judges should only intervene if there had been intentional acts of discrimination. He worked on this case for a trade organization and said on television that the government should treat people as individuals, not part of a racial group. It almost seems like his ideas about race were a theme in his life, and I wanted to just get you to talk about that and how much you think they're influencing his opinions on the court and how they may influence the rulings that he'll make as a, you know, as now the leader, of course, of the conservative bloc and the Chief Justice.
You know, that's exactly right. What I have said in this book is that a straight line can be drawn from his early memos on race for the Reagan administration and then for the H.W. Bush administration to where he sits in the center chair now. Yeah. Rulings on school integration, rulings on the Voting Rights Act, rulings on campus affirmative action, any kind of minority set-aside program. He has been so consistent on that. And I'm glad you're picking up on when he becomes Deputy Solicitor General, because we can remind people that he was working for Ken Starr.
Yeah.
Ken Starr hired him both in the Reagan administration, and then Ken Starr becomes U.S. Solicitor General, being the top individual arguing before the Supreme Court, and hires as his political deputy a young John Roberts. And that case you referred to right away about the minority set-asides, and it happened to be in broadcasting, Ken Starr had to recuse himself from that case because he had handled it when he was a judge on the D.C. Circuit. But John Roberts took control and immediately actually changes the federal government's position there, saying that the Federal Communications Commission should not have special programs for minorities, to try to boost their representation in the broadcast industry for reasons of diversity. And he gets the government to argue it vigorously. They lose by one vote, thanks to then William Brennan, who steered the majority there. But then a few years later, that gets reversed. So John Roberts ends up getting his way on the minority set asides. But he thinks these out, and he's obviously an excellent lawyer. But it's this time when he's Deputy Solicitor General, arguing these cases before the court, that he's actually able to refine opinions and refine his legal rationale that you see threads of throughout his legal career and now on the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. Does Roberts believe there should be any kind of accommodation now for an ugly, racist past? Because it seems like this is one of the themes that I detected in the book, how Roberts tries to strike that balance between, addressing that history of racism and public discrimination and the way remedies were applied, like racial quotas and other accommodations, which he didn't like. But how does he balance all of that?
This is one area where there really is no balance. Yeah. There is really no balancing, because he believes that these kinds of racial remedies actually are more harmful than solutions here. In fact, he has this famous line that he wrote in a 2007 case, the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. He has been adamant here. This is one area where there's been no deviation from the pattern, as we've seen in other areas, and that I believe will happen now that he's at the ideological center of the Supreme Court. And he's obviously gotten crosswise inside the court with some of the justices, for example, Sonia Sotomayor, the first Latina on the court. And it's caused lots of controversy beyond the Marble Palace, as it's called, just because when he says things have changed in America, things are different now in the South, we no longer need these kinds of remedies for past discrimination, just for diversity's sake, people say, you're not seeing what we're seeing.
So interesting that you mentioned the Sotomayor. There's a moment when she basically turns that, what seemed like a kind of a flippant statement by him, you know, the right way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to, you know, not discriminate on the basis of race. Or, you know, she turns that against him in an opinion. And she writes, the right way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is, now her words, to speak openly and candidly on the subject of race and to apply the Constitution with eyes open to the unfortunate effects of centuries of racial discrimination. She goes right after the Chief Justice on this one, and he doesn't like it a bit.
Oh, man, that was, I'll never forget that. I was in the courtroom that day, and then obviously I read his statement. He writes, this is in spring of 2014, in a case out of Michigan that involved affirmative action, but having to do with a voter referendum on racial classifications in government, particularly in higher education. John Roberts' side wins. They say that it's okay that a state has, you know, put these restrictions saying you can't have these race-based programs. His side wins, but Sotomayor's dissent angers him so much he writes a separate concurring statement, which is very unlike him. He doesn't do that very often. And he's put off by her suggestion that he just doesn't get it. Mm-hmm. That because in that same opinion that you just read from Doug, she also talks about the experiences of people of color of experiencing the slights, the snickers, the feelings that we don't belong, and that kind of sort of personal revelation from her, and the strong attack on the justices in the majority set him off, and he responds in a way that's almost, you know, how dare you, and suggests that, you know, Justice Sotomayor is sort of airing some dirty laundry here and not giving him credit for wanting to take on an issue. And I'm not sure, I'm remembering the word clueless as if he's saying, you know, it's wrong to indict us as not being aware of problems in society when we're trying to work them out in another way. So he could not abide the kind of criticism he was getting from Justice Sotomayor there.
One final point on the race question, because it does, I did wonder throughout, how can someone with such a privileged background, who is almost entirely isolated from any actual encounters with people of color in his upbringing, who had some reason to be resentful of racial policies that affected his father's employment, how can someone with that background come to these kinds of conclusions in a truly objective way?
Well, I'm sure he believes he is coming to his conclusions in a perfectly objective way.
Yeah.
I have no doubt about that. I have no doubt that he would never consider himself as trying to harm in any way people of color. And in fact, he has written extensively about how he thinks that these kinds of racial remedies do more harm than good. And he's also been very, very bold in his interpretation of Brown v. Board of Education in a way that the majority of the court found implausible. And Justice Kennedy even broke away from him in this 2007 case that we referred to earlier, saying, You're not understanding how much more work has to go on in America and what Brown v. Board was all about. He's very firm about this, and all I can tell you is that he has not shown any defensiveness for this position as mm-hmm. he might in other areas.
We should talk a little bit about, as you do in the book, his focus, his intensity. You mention his first argument before the Supreme Court. This was in 1989. He's in private practice at the time. He's nervous, trying to keep his hands from shaking. He sort of gets hold of the lectern and, you know, tries to steady himself. Presents himself the picture of calm, though. He has the steady voice, hardly ever stammers. And I just wanted to get a sense of what kind of work went into that? Because you talk about how he was always prepared. He engaged in these practice rounds. He was always prepared. He worked really hard, which gets to why he would say perseverance is really important, I guess.
That's right. You know, he's personally fairly shy. Mm-hmm. And I found out through my interviews for the book that he, even as he got older and did more and more appearances before the Supreme Court, still would have shaking hands, still would feel an upset stomach. And colleagues who he was working with would say, how could this be happening? This is John Roberts. But he always had to quell his nerves, and his preparation was supreme. He would work and work and work to figure out how to have the best transitions between points he wanted to make, irrespective of the kinds of questions he would get from the bench. If he had trouble pronouncing a name, he would find other ways to describe that individual, perhaps by their title rather than by their last name, if he couldn't quite say it without stammering. He was so good. And even that first oral argument that he did in January of 1989, when you listen to it and when you see the transcript, you know, both things I did many times, he had to answer, I don't know, to individual justices' questions on many occasions. He actually didn't know some answers, but his voice never betrayed whatever anxiety he had. And during one earlier interview I had with him that was on the record before I started the book, he told me that he would hate to go back and read the transcripts because he was so fearful of mistakes he would see. And of course, this is a guy who became the gold standard. But I think that was part of what made him so good, is he would prepare and prepare and prepare and was ready for anything. So you're right, this gets to his notion that persistence is what matters. But think of the setting in the Supreme Court. It is very controlled. He has, you know, he can be thrown a curveball a bit from one of the justices, but not anything like a litigator faces and dealing with a jury. There are many more knowns when you're dealing in appellate law. And I think that was a very comfortable setting for him.
It's interesting you write about his preparation for his interview with President George W. Bush when he was being considered for the court. He was prepared. He understood. He used baseball metaphors with George W. Bush. He came into that interview ready. And you also talk about how he understood the importance of a human touch. This was also interesting to me.
So true. And I had the benefit of George Bush's recollections in his own memoir about that meeting. So we find that, you know, John Roberts rolled out that umpire metaphor. President Bush responds very favorably to it. John Roberts uses it again during his 2005 hearings. And but he also works in plenty of his own personality that George W. Bush then writes about how he saw a man with a gentle soul. So it was he obviously got the job done. Let's just put it that way.
Right.
But he did. It wasn't without some preparation and testing his thoughts against some close friends to say, what do you think? Does this work? Does that not work? And frankly, why would you not? Why would you not? One line in the book that I especially appreciated came from one of his competitors at the time, Michael Luttig, who's now general counsel at Boeing, but at one point had been an appeals court judge like John Roberts was. And Mike Luttig felt he was completely prepared for his interview with George Bush, but, you know, he didn't get it the way John Roberts did. And Mike Luttig said to me in one of my interviews with him, John Roberts has always seen everything with pristine clarity and almost instantly. And he said when he used to argue with him that he had him nine ways to Sunday. He was aware of John Roberts' talent, even though he, of course, thought he should have gotten the job.
Yeah. I did want to point out also, this was something that I thought was interesting in terms of his style, his just legal approach, that he wanted to have a conversational tone, you mentioned. And he also would describe lawsuits in narratives, that he saw them as stories, which seemed like a pretty effective technique.
Completely. He said it might take you, you know, a paragraph or two in a written brief or a few minutes during your oral arguments, but it gives the judges who are hearing your case something to latch on to. And even in his public speaking now, he tends to have little moments in history that he wants to invoke. He still does that and does it very effectively.
This gets us to really a central theme in the book and something you really explore. And that is what we were mentioning before, how you see John Roberts' obligation to protecting the institution of the Supreme Court and fulfilling his ideas about his conservative ideology and how they should play out in society. And the Affordable Care Act is the perfect way of talking about this. Set this up for us, if you would. You mentioned how talk about how Roberts is thinking about the Affordable Care Act as it comes to him, because you say that early on he's wanting to craft compromise, but he's not sure his fellow conservatives think that that can be done. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
That's right. This is where I discovered in my reporting that he changed course multiple times and actually in two major ways switched his vote. But let's bring everybody back to 2012, because I think the atmosphere was part of it. It was an election year. Every Republican running for president said that he or she would repeal it. It was such a big deal. It was the 2010 law itself was President Obama's signature domestic achievement. And, you know, it had come up through lower courts. Everybody was watching what was going to happen. It gets to the Supreme Court, and all eyes are on this conservative-dominated Supreme Court. Would they rule 5-4? Would they rule in the pattern of the 5 Republican appointees against the 4 Democratic appointees? And John Roberts really didn't want that. But John Roberts also did not think on the initial vote that the central provision of the Affordable Care Act, that was the requirement that everybody buy insurance, known as the individual mandate, he did not believe that that was constitutional under Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce. So they have this historic 3 days of oral arguments. And at the end of the week, the justices vote in their private conference room to strike down the individual mandate. And it's the 5 conservatives led by John Roberts. But at the same time, just as an aside, something that never got much attention then, they also voted to uphold this key Medicaid expansion program that was going to help people at the poverty line. And that was sort of, in terms of the media coverage, that seemed like a bit of an afterthought, but it was a very important part of the law. So as John Roberts is working on his opinion, he keeps the opinion for himself, as is his prerogative of the Chief Justice. He's exploring what other provisions should fall with the individual mandate provision. And the conservatives, to his right, all want the whole law to fall. They say this thing is so intertwined, this nearly 1,000-page law that covers, you know, pre-existing conditions, guarantees that if you have cancer or diabetes, you're not going to be kicked off your plan, that children who are, you know, up to, I think it was 26, would still be covered. You know, all the things that are very popular out in America, that those wouldn't fall with the individual insurance requirement. But Justice Kennedy and the other conservatives at the time wanted it all to fall, and John Roberts just could not abide that. And he ends up switching his vote and developing this tax rationale, saying that the law can be upheld based on Congress's power to tax. Now, I should tell you, Doug, that was never voted on in the conference room. I found that out, and that's what caused a lot of unhappiness with the justices to his right wing. But then as he's trying to write this opinion, he doesn't get any real cooperation with his fellow conservatives, and he moves toward Justices Breyer and Elena Kagan, who are kind of the more moderate liberals. Justices Sotomayor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg are further over to the left. He starts working with them, and as they're working on this compromise, John Roberts then switches his vote on the Medicaid provision, the expansion part, to say that should fall. So he gives with one hand, takes away with the other, and in this whole compromise process, Justices Kagan and Breyer also switch their votes. So in the end, the public sees a 5-4 vote to uphold the individual mandate and 7-2 to curtail the Medicaid plan, when neither of those votes had occurred on the first round.
So how do you explain it? And this gets us sort of finally to the question. You mentioned, however the chief would explain that vote for the Affordable Care Act, that this case added, as you put it in the book, a new dimension to a man who insisted he always decided cases based on the law. So what is the final conclusion you think about how he's now? Of course, he's, you know, firmly, you say the majority is pointed firmly in one direction. So how is the Chief Justice going to still insist judging has nothing to do with politics? What's the role? Is he going to sublimate his views? Where do you think he's going to end up now?
Yeah, I think that what that whole episode showed is that he wasn't just calling balls and strikes. You know, he wasn't just taking on the role of the umpire, if any judge ever really can do something like that, because it's a lot more complicated than a strike zone. But I think it showed that at this time, when the country is much more polarized, the conservative majority is much more cemented without the key centrist vote of Anthony Kennedy, that he's going to be looking for ways to signal to the country that this is not a conservative, polarized court like the rest of the country. I anticipate that he would inch to the left in certain disputes, that he would work to try to avoid certain ideological litmus tests. And we've already seen, frankly, both those moves. But I do think there are some concerns of his that will never change, even in this turbulent time. I think he'll still be dug in on his racial views. I don't think those are going to change. Mm. But I think when it comes to some, you know, separation of powers issues, some issues involving Donald Trump, I don't think he'll be as ready to reinforce Donald Trump's notion that the Supreme Court is in his pocket. Mm-hmm. In fact, I know he won't want to reinforce that notion. Right. So I could see him definitely.
Abortion, we should mention too. Reproductive rights. That was an important dimension we weren't able to get into.
That's right. And for your listeners, you should know that the court right now has been holding on to cases involving abortion rights and some discrimination claims based on sexual orientation and gender identity, not saying whether the justices will take these issues up. And I think one of the reasons is that the chief really doesn't want those tests right now.
Hmm. Well, as you finally put it, the law will likely be what he says it is. He's in charge right now.
That's right. It's such an unusual situation. You know, we started with my mentioning that I got this idea back in 2015 when Justice Scalia was still alive and Anthony Kennedy was the decider. But now John Roberts, the Chief Justice, is overseeing a court that's both his in name and in reality, because he is at the ideological center of this court.
Joan Biskupic, her book is The Chief, The Life and Turbulent Times of Supreme Court Justice John Roberts. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.